Deconstructionist Radio presents The War Room, where we discuss tactics for strategic Christian living.
Mighty Lord, extend your kingdom, be the truth with triumph crown. Let the lambs that sit in darkness hear the glorious gospel sound.
Good morning. This is Bill Evans. Welcome to the War Room. You're going to hear some background noise this morning. I'm here in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, at the Heartland Travel Center with Derek Evans, fence builder, organic farmer, expectant father, and pastor of a yet to be determined affiliation local congregation here in Swamp East, Missouri, Poplar Bluff, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And welcome to the War Room.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. I'm glad you stopped by. I'm always wondering when you're going to get through this part of the country, so I'm glad we've got a chance to get together and talk.
Yeah, well, my dad lives, as you know, our listeners don't know, but my dad only lives 20 miles east of here, so I visited him last night briefly. He's 84 years old. But this is sort of impromptu, and I don't want you to be conscious of the microphone. Right. I'm just going to hold it while we talk, because one of the things, a premise of our War Room podcast, is to be tactical and to think about solutions. And oftentimes I paint this mental image of everybody sort of, you know, who's a male at least, and most people who are older know about, let's say, the Battle of Iwo Jima.
Right.
Which actually was a month-long campaign. And the Marine Corps is pinned down on the beach, and they're triangulated, but withering fire, and in front of them is Mount Suribachi, and their goal is to plant the flag and vanquish the Japanese from the island. And they've got all kinds of impediments, pillboxes, entrapments, hidden machine gun nests, minefields, booby traps. And there is the goal, Mount Suribachi, let's say. And the question in everybody's mind, or certainly the commander's mind, the tactical questions is, how do we get there from here? The strategy is to get there. The tactics are, how do we get there?
Right.
What are the impediments? And so, you know, you're in a, what's the population of
was it? I think the county population is around 40,000.
So it's a small,
right.
It's agricultural based somewhat. I mean, the eastern part of the county is flat, delta.
Right.
And then you're right at the foothill of the Ozark Highlands, somewhat. You're the,
right,
the current river country. And so you live in the country, but you pastor a, for those who don't know Derek, he pastors a small church that he just led out of the Presbyterian Church USA by unanimous vote. They voted to leave after basically you had been teaching and preaching to them for what, about a year?
Yeah, about a year and a half, maybe a little less. All right.
What are some of the, did your people express the fact, obviously they were starving, right, for TLC.
Right.
They needed someone to care for their souls and to, but have, did they, I'm just curious, after never having really, were they reformed?
Were they reformed? They all memorized the catechism as kids in church.
It's an older congregation.
Right. And they were an older congregation. One of the elders is 61, looks younger. His wife's 50.
Well, I'm 62, so that's right. that's not old.
So they're, we're getting a few younger people now, but they were pretty much the young family. They have kids younger than, they have two in college now, and one's in high, just a freshman in high school. Besides for that, and some of their peers that they went to school with are there as well, grew up together, grew up the church together, were baptized in that church and came up, and they had just lost their minister. Actually, they properly executed church discipline on their minister.
Against the minister?
Yes.
Well, it shouldn't go without saying that this is sort of a Reformed wasteland anyway. This
Absolutely.
Is Church of Christ, Pentecostal holiness, some Assemblies of God, and of course the Baptists.
This town is actually the General Baptist World Headquarters, and it doesn't get any more Arminian than that. I mean, you look on the website, and they say we're Arminian. So it's... That's even in the Southern Baptist churches around here, a lot of the people have come out of a General Baptist church. And if you're Reformed in the Southern Baptist church around here, you're a closet Calvinist, kind of keep it to yourself kind of deal. Unfortunately, I started up some guys about that and say, well, if this is really what you believe, why aren't you preaching this? I mean, why aren't you preaching the whole counsel of God? And so we'll run into that a little bit here.
Yeah, you know... The idea that people are holding their true beliefs to themselves for political reasons is sort of antithetical to the Christian faith.
It shows a lack of faith. It shows a lack of faith on their part on, hey, if I would just preach the whole counsel of God and do what God commands, I see the truth in Scripture, I know what the truth is, but I'm holding back because it may offend somebody. And you don't have to preach it in an offensive way. But I'm holding back because it may offend someone, may affect my position here at the church, then you're doing it wrong.
Well, I can see that that's part of the charge of recons, that you know people may hold to a particular view of this or that and keep it on the down low simply for the sake of not majoring in the minors and trying to maintain peace,
right,
and say, you know, keep calm and press on. Keep calm and move the ball.
Right.
But we were talking the other night, and I know that in the intervening time since our last conversation, you haven't had time to do much of anything. By the way, how's your wife holding out?
She's doing good. She's tired of being pregnant, miserably pregnant. But baby will be here in, I think I asked her this morning, 32 weeks. She's 32 weeks pregnant right now, so coming up soon.
And she's still practicing law.
She is.
So that must be quite the sight in the courtroom.
It is. It is. And like I said, it's a small town. She practices in this county and the surrounding counties. She's from Donovan, the town next to, so everybody knows her in the courtroom. And just, it's quite the sight. Maybe it gets some sympathy from jurors sometimes.
Well, if she goes into labor, she's sure to have a police escort to the hospital.
Right. Yeah, that's right. For what that's worth.
Yeah. Anyway, we're talking about kingdom building in a small town and tactical Christianity. How do we get there from here? And we were kind of kicking around the idea the other night. This is that I was sharing with you, and we're going to just kind of brainstorm on the mic here for a few minutes while we enjoy our coffee. And that is, I'm on my way to Wyoming and just wanted to stop through and see Derek. But anyway... Listening to Tim Yarbrough and getting to know him a little bit and being amazed at some of his practical steps that he's taken in a small town where, he, like yourself, he knows everybody and everybody
right.
knows him. And you're a pretty well-known figure around town, a friendly.
Yeah. My family's been, I'm the fifth generation here. Yeah.
Okay.
We've been around a lot.
The other person... And is Roger Oliver, who's former Special Forces, who's down at the Pierre Verre Institute in Puebla, Mexico,
mm-hmm.
which is a metropolitan city of several million people.
Right.
It's a big city. But their strategy was, as I mentioned, and I kind of came up with the illustration of a three-legged stool
mm-hmm.
that they have. First, they had the education, because every parent wants their children to have a good education, and of course the education is not just about increasing knowledge, but it's to train them. I was talking to Tim Brown today's War Room podcast about raising post-millennial kids
mm-hmm.
in a dispensational world, so to speak.
Yeah, this is as dispensational as it gets. We're living here too.
And so so the purpose of education is not just to teach them to read, write, and do arithmetic, but it's to train, to equip them with the mindset to extend Christ's kingdom in every area. And it may not look like kingdom building.
Right.
Because it's a lot of it, like Levin, you know, mm-hmm. Levin doesn't, you know, I was just reading in Gary North's Unconditional Surrender about Levin and just you know, what kingdom building looks like is not maybe what we think it looks like. It's like spending time with your boy fishing.
Right.
Is kingdom building.
Absolutely. It,
you know, planting a garden or pulling weeds, taking dominion over the dirt. That's kingdom building and preaching and evangelism, all those things. So, but he started out with education. And then they found that, well, the people, they have to pay something. It can't be free.
Right.
It has to be. They have to have skin in the game. And so to pay anything, most of them didn't have any money.
Right.
So he had to provide jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So they started making furniture. And then, of course, he had to sell the furniture. But so basically, and then so the people who were sending their kids to the school who wanted to came to work for them in many cases, and then that became the basis of his congregation. And rather than a temple model, which is most United States corporate churches are, you know, they're temple models versus the synagogue model, where you're basically, I want to talk to somebody like Steve Schlissel, who really understands that temple model better. But it's synagogue model, but it's kind of like what we would call low church.
Right.
It may not even look like church to the people that are looking at it. They're saying, well, they just gather at their home for a meal.
Right.
They're just having friends over. And but what does it look like when the body of Christ meets together? And people have this idea that, well, they're all sitting in straight back chairs facing the front, and a guy is standing up there talking at them or talking to them. And I said, well, why? Well, I said, when the body of Christ meets together, why doesn't it just look like a fish fry or a backyard target shooting or, a barn raising or helping somebody move?
Right.
You know, that's what the body of Christ looks like when it meets together.
Well, I think about that, too, and I think we don't have a large description of what the early church looked like, but I'm going to make some assumptions here. We see Paul writing this letter to Philemon, really putting him on spot, because these letters that Paul writes are read in front of the whole body, everybody that's there together. And Philemon's slave has run off and is helping Paul, and Philemon's pretty much saying to Paul, Paul's pretty much saying to Philemon, hey, have mercy and, you know, accept this guy back. Don't give him a hard time. Puts him on spot in front of everybody. Where are they meeting at? I believe they're meeting at Philemon's house. That's where they're meeting at. Philemon's got some money. He has a place for everybody to kind of meet together. But they're doing this work. They're doing these things out in the open where everybody can see it. Everyone can drive down our main drag here, and you can't go a quarter of a mile without passing three churches. And all people can see is the church building. They can't see the people inside of it. They can't see what's going on. And they don't really see them out in the community doing much. Yeah, we might give away some food every now and then or something like that. But they don't really see people living life together. They don't see people sitting at the table in the truck stop talking about Christ, talking about things that, oh, that's usually kept inside the church building. That's usually kept inside the walls. I know I mentioned this was a primary dispensational community, and we understand how that eschatology affects your kingdom building stuff and affects how you do things out in the world. You separate yourself from these politics. Well, supposed to, in their worldview. You know, when we look at the way, and I like the guy a lot, and I learned a lot from his teachings, but we look at how, like, a MacArthur operates, to where, oh, church, we stay out of politics.
Yeah, sometimes even more than we say dispensational / two kingdom.
Right.
Because there really is a real clear two kingdom distinction.
Absolutely, there is. But and not to just dog on every church around here, they're inconsistent in their two kingdom theology on a lot of things. Because I send one of my kids over here to Independent Fundamental Baptist School, its own, you know, private Christian school in the town. And he gets his theology from home. But for the most part, they do a good job. And you look at this congregation there, and it's a fairly large one. And even though they have this dispensational eschatology, it really, they're inconsistent in how they operate.
Because, happily.
Yes. They're inconsistent in how they operate, which is a good thing, because it actually does affect the rest of their life. And I think them having a school is a big part of that, too, because they're not separating just church from everything else. Okay, we go here.
Does your child have a note that says he's exempt from pledging allegiance to the flag?
He doesn't, but I'm not sure that they pledge allegiance to the flag in there. But, yeah, well, I know.
That's a good question to ask.
I know when they had last year some graduation or awards deal that we went to. And, of course, like many churches, they're even ignorantly idolatrous, because here they have their Lord's table, or whatever they're wanting to call it up front here, where they have their altar is what they'll call it here, because they do the altar call thing pretty big. And then they got the American flag hanging up over here, the Christian flag, you know, right here, and then on the other side they have a cross hanging up there, and they'll do the Pledge of Allegiance. And I've always wondered, which we don't get many up here in Southeast Missouri, but how does that look to the sojourner when the sojourner shows up to worship with you, someone traveling through town, and in that whole hour and a half you spend out of the entire week supposedly dedicating that time with the Lord, you are pledging allegiance to a flag that has a star representing a million babies, 50 stars, one for each million babies that we've sacrificed to the God of convenience, and get upset about that thing. And Bill, I'm as patriotic as the next guy. I'm an ex-service member, you know, went to war and all this good stuff. And no one can accuse me of being the commie hippie guy because I'm saying, hey, I don't want to stand up in what's supposed to be the place where we're worshiping God and pledge allegiance to something that is a blip in history. Because it really is. People don't understand when we look at our country, how it's broken covenant with God, that we've been a country for less time than a period God punished Israel for disobeying him. And when we look at the whole thing of things, so we've been around less than 250 years,
yeah.
And you can't walk into one of these churches, for lack of a better word, and say, okay, in the next week I'm going to tell them everything they're doing wrong and change it. Because human nature, someone walks up to you or I and says, hey, listen, guys, you're doing this wrong, everything you're doing is wrong, and I'm going to change you within a week. Well, we're going to be stubborn and we're going to buck up, and we probably are just going to shut them off right at the beginning. But local church here in town, and it's so prevalent among the SBC, and there are some good SBC churches. There's some good, you know, Reformed Baptist SBC churches that are just in the SBC for one purpose. And when I ask people, why are you part of the SBC? Well, they really believe in the IMB, which probably they're getting fed up with, because the IMB wastes a lot of
money. IMB?
International Mission Board.
I mean, the Lottie Moon?
Right. Well, with David Platt is the head of the International Mission Board now. And, hey, there's a good missionary right there. That guy, I believe, comes to missions, he's a solid guy. He's not these, hey, we're going on a two-week vacation to go dig a well so we can fill it back in and send another group to dig it next week kind of deal. I mean, this guy's really mission-minded, and he's the best guy they can have leading this International Mission Board now. But it's this co-op that all these SBC churches pay into, but the money's been mishandled so poorly. So it really is a reflection of our government and our country, the way the money's mishandled with the bureaucracies and all this stuff. So it really reflects poorly. But that's why a lot of these people find themselves in this SBC, these associations of churches.
Well, who is it? Was it North or Rushton? He wrote a book on the failure of the Baptist culture. It was one of those two. And I was thinking about that. You know, if you propose to Baptists,
right,
that number one, there's such a thing as a Baptist culture,
right?
Because they're just Americans, you know. But if you tell them that there's a Baptist culture, mm-hmm. And this is, by the way, this is no slam against our recon,
right,
Baptists,
absolutely,
because they don't possess a Baptist culture, mm-hmm. But there is a Baptist culture, and it's not designed or intended to build the kingdom of God.
Right. Well, and a good example, I think, that's when you look at Joseph Spurgeon. I bet he sticks out like a sore thumb up there around all the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary students.
And he mentions that there, evidently, he says that there's a growing number of post-millennialists.
Yeah.
And hopefully these are people that are reading. Of course, Spurgeon was not post-millennial, but sometimes he sounded like he was. But anyway, yeah, he says there's a growing number of people, so ebb and flow. But back to how you reach a small town, and of course how you inculcate a group with your perspectives. You know, you talked about, I think what you said, you don't blast in and hey, you're wrong, and I'm going to change you. You ease them into it.
Yeah.
One of Tim Yarbrough's, he talks about, and I think one of your strengths is your relationship. And you're known as a hardworking guy who's an ethical businessman. You own a commercial fence business.
Right.
And you go out of the way to run everything in an above board manner. And everybody, I mean, you don't put crosses on your fences. You just build good fences, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that it's a, you know, someone you'd interviewed before was talking about hard work. Who was that you were interviewing with that was talking about
work and about using work as evangelism?
Absolutely.
Martin Salbrady.
Right. And that was a great point right there. And I have more opportunities, which we all do. We just don't take advantage of them. We need to repent for this. I don't take advantage of them all the time. With my job, I'm working somewhere different every week. Someone else's house. I mean, I'm in the local area, but I run into such a number of people. And there's your evangelism opportunities right there. Way more than I will get from standing behind a pulpit. My job standing behind the pulpit is to train those people in the congregation to go out and do the evangelism during the week in their everyday lives. And it's a lot easier to go a state over where nobody knows you and do evangelism there instead of here with the people that you grew up with, because it puts you, and as bad as I hate to say it, but we all have to admit it, we feel ashamed for some reason sometimes to be evangelizing to people that we know, or people that said, well, these people know my past, these people might know the things I used to do and things I used to run around and do. It's the whole I'm over in the next town. I'm two towns over preaching at this church. No one there really knows me. It's so much easier for me there because I like to say, well, the prophet's not welcome in his hometown.
You know, since we're just kicking this around, you know what the solution, and Jesus gave the solution to fear and to timidity. Mm-hmm. In evangelism, don't ever do it by yourself.
Right, absolutely.
Do it. Take all anything. Everything should be a teaching opportunity. So anytime you are doing something for the kingdom, you should be doing it with someone else, so that it is not only are you doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. but you're being used as a teaching opportunity.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, obviously there will be providential opportunities that arise.
Yeah.
But
absolutely there will.
But, you know, this very useful quote of Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
He said that a hero is simply a coward with another coward standing next to him.
Yeah.
In other words, two are better than one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you and I dare say that even though you're a big guy and a manly guy and all that, and I guess I'm sort of somewhere in that category, neither one of us would be perceived by most people as being timid.
Right.
Or shy. But we both know in our heart of hearts that there have been many times we have shrunk back from seizing the opportunities that were in front of us.
Absolutely.
Either because we were too distracted, too tired, too whatever, or sometimes because we just didn't have the proper love of our neighbor.
That's what it is. I told you a story this week about one of the young ladies I run into, that homeless girl. I almost drove away because I thought, you know what, I'm on my way to do this. I have these important things to do. And I was prioritizing in my mind my own things that I wanted to do above speaking to this girl that was rock bottom perfect place to share the gospel with or to love your neighbor with. And I almost drove away. I got in my truck, started to drive away, and I thought, you know, God has put this right. I am held accountable for doing this. And to tell you the truth, guilt and the fear of God is what led me to do it at that time. It turned into love for my neighbor. But I think, you know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. So I think the fear of God is a good reason to do it. God told me to do it, and I'm about to disobey his commandment, so I should be in fear because I will be punished for it. But it does have to come out of that love of your heart, and that love is not inherently in me as a person. So it is the love of Christ that shines through me.
But if you had been with, if you had had another brother hanging with you, or you'd been with your wife, more, or even maybe a child, where you want to give an example,
absolutely,
it would. So that's why Christ tactically sends his followers out in twos.
We look at a good example of why he does that too, where we have Peter denying Christ, standing there by himself. If we would have had, it was inevitable. Christ told him he was going to do it. But if he would have had some of the other guys standing there,
he had Andrew with him.
Right.
If Andrew had been with him,
it would have been a lot. It would have turned out differently. And the reason I believe he tells us to go out in twos is because he knows our human nature, and he knows we aren't capable of doing it by ourselves.
Yeah. Well, everybody, if you haven't memorized Ecclesiastes 4:9, you should. Everyone should know that verse. Ecclesiastes 4:9 and 10. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If one falls, the other will lift up his companion, but woe to the one who falls when there is no one else to pick him up.
Absolutely.
That's tactically speaking, you know, it's like there's no Rambos in this fight.
Yeah.
Nobody is a Rambo. Nobody is. In fact, I would dare say, although there have been some exceptional instances in history with like people like William Carey, but even he had assistance. But we are not called to go this alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm alone with Ruger most of the time, but I'm blessed that I can always have. Bojadar, or you, or Scott Buss, or someone with me via Reconstructionist Radio, or the Ministry of CDs or whatnot, audio books, and I'm on the phone with people all the time. I think my advantage is that I get to listen. I have the time to listen and study while I'm working.
That's an advantage I have too. I work by myself most of the time. My grandma works with me quite a bit, but I might have another guy working with me. But there's so many times I just want to be by myself working on my job, and I plug my headphones in, and there I go, you know, listening to whatever. Now, you know, I've not been to seminary. I considered it here in the last couple of years, but I can't justify spending the money. I can't justify the time apart from my family, and I know a lot of guys. Well, I just blasphemed saying, oh, I don't really care about going to seminary. And I'm not saying this is a cop-out.
No, I don't think you're ruffling Reconstructionist feathers, because everybody I've talked to, from Joe Moorcraft to Matt Trujillo to Phil Kaiser, all these people basically say that the greatest, the weakest link in the entire chain is the seminary system.
Well, at the same time, it's free. Online, I can get the exact same information, plug into it with my headphones, and I'm not paying $300 a credit hour to some institution. And all I have to have is the motivation to do it, instead of me paying someone to be my babysitter and saying, you have to do A, B, and C. Not that there isn't things that I could learn from these people in person, obviously. I'm not the most educated in these things, but Ligonier Ministries. I can go online and listen to, if you listen to any what is considered a sermon, one of R.C. Sproul's sermon, you hear him writing on a chalkboard. He's sitting there giving a seminary lecture, and I can sit here and listen to five of them in a row that would have took me 5 weeks in an institution somewhere to get, and I'm pretty lucky as I can absorb that stuff pretty well.
If you're
interested in it, you can absorb it well.
Well, let me ask you this question. You're a fence builder, right?
Right.
Did you read a book on building fences?
No, I did not. I was discipled in the building. My grandpa did it for 40-something years.
So you learned by doing.
Right.
And that's the that's the primary fallacy and the weakness of the seminary system, is you learn by doing.
Right. Now, I'm not knocking guys that choose to go to seminary, obviously.
No.
It's nice when I can, which I could learn this on my own. It's nice if I have a guy that can read Hebrew and Greek and can do these kind of deep study stuff. But for the lay person, which is 99% of Christians, the body, the true church, is not seminary educated people that are actually out doing this work.
Well, I can actually recommend a guy who will tutor you on Greek over the phone,
mm-hmm.
an hour a week.
Right.
He wrote his own Greek book, and you know what he used to do before he was a Greek teacher?
What's that?
He was a DJ.
There you go.
He didn't realize until he was about 35 years old that he had this God-given ability to read languages in a way that most people don't read languages.
Right.
And he taught himself Greek
mm-hmm.
and Latin. And I don't know if he taught himself Hebrew, but he is a single brother, lives up in St. Louis.
Right.
And his name is Robert Wormuth. He's probably not expecting a shout-out from me. We were roommates years ago in Columbia, South Carolina. And he actually taught at Covenant Seminary. And he's got a little book. It's called The Green Book, The Green Greek Book.
Right.
And he taught me in 6 weeks. I could translate, the final test.
Right.
For his 6-week summer Greek course was to translate the book of 1 John, which is simple Greek.
Yeah.
But, and of course, it helped if you had big chunks of it memorized.
Right.
But, which I did, but that was the bottom, in 6 weeks, basically teach a guy to exegete mm-hmm. and translate from the Greek into English. And so if that was something...
It's something I'd like to do.
As a companion to your
right.
good online tools.
Right.
That's
what I was about to say. It's not at the top of my priority list right now because I can open up my phone or my iPad or my computer and I got a lexicon right there. What's this say in the Greek? What does this word mean?
Yeah, you got vines or you got kittle or whatever you want.
It's all there. I mean...
We really do have amazing tools of dominion.
We absolutely do because, like this Rush Juni's and Calvin's Institutes, we have them there in book form. We have them there on PDF. We have them on our phones. We can have them on audio. And all of this stuff that 150 years ago, we would have to spend years and years studying and writing and figuring out is at the touch of my fingers.
But usually, if you listen to much in the way of audiobooks, you know that audiobooks generally spur the sale of paper books.
Right.
Because you want the books after
Absolutely.
You've listened to them because you want to be able to make notations in the mm-hmm. in the columns and in the margins and to write notes and underline and look back that and cover.
And you can absorb it so much better.
And sometimes
most of the time.
Hey, and listen, there's power outages in mm-hmm. the winter.
That's right.
And nothing is as romantic as laying in bed
right.
with your honey reading Institutes of Biblical Law.
Oh, yeah. That gets the fires going.
Anyway, so we're talking about building a three. Tell us about what you do here, and what is your strategy for transforming Butler County into a kingdom outpost?
Honestly, well,
And I'm not putting you on the spot here.
I know, but
brainstorm.
My focus, obviously, has been in the next county over,
which is Stoddard County.
Right.
Malden's not Stoddard.
No, Malden's not.
Is
Malden's
it Howell or what? No, no.
I don't even know. I don't know what county it is.
How are you going to take America one county at a time?
I guess I'll transform it one city at a time.
Malden, Missouri, which is really sort of
there's some problems there. There's no work there for anyone. And I told you something that has kind of been weighing on me, and they have a large fatherless problem there. If we look at the community, the money there, and actually when you look at the median income of Malden, it's the same as Butler County, which you wouldn't think so, but you have, that's farm country over there. You've got guys farming 5 or 6,000 acres, so they have a lot of money. So when you look at the average
They have
income,
a lot of debt, one of the
that,
two.
Well, they, One of the two, yeah, both. They have a lot of money and assets. They don't have a lot of liquid money, but they might own 6,000 acres that's worth $3,000
and a couple $1 million worth of farm equipment.
Right. Yeah, easily. So when you look at the median income, say, oh, the median income over here is $13,000 per person, $30,000 per household. Now, that's rough. That's rough. Now, cost of living is cheaper here than it is going to be pretty much anywhere else in the United States. I can, I'm building a house right now, myself, me and my dad are. It's probably going to take me 3 years to finish it, but I'm not going to owe any money. It's going to be paid for, and when I get done, I'm going to have several thousand square feet, but go buy something like that somewhere else. Buy a house here in this area. You get a four-bedroom house, something that if you live on the West Coast in California, you're going to be paying $600,000-$700,000 or more for, and here you get for $170,000-$180,000.
No, the cost of living is relatively cheap.
It is relatively cheap.
Cigarettes and beer are cheap in Southeast Missouri.
Yeah, they are. And also, but for some reason, I've noticed lately, they've been taking advantage of people around here. Rent's kind of high.
Well, because, you know, usually poor people don't have the option of moving.
That's it. So all
they don't have the mobility, so they're in the crosshairs of the landlord.
And it's kind
of
like when I was in the service.
And small municipalities are continuing to raise property taxes on landlords to build for more better county and local civil government. They want better the law enforcement. They want they want fire trucks like the big cities have. I noticed the high school here in Poplar Bluff.
Oh yeah.
Now Poplar Bluff had a high school downtown. Remember right there at the intersection with the the water tower is no longer there.
No, they moved it.
Oh wow. But anyway, and now they've got this thing. Looks like this building was probably $20 or $30 million.
Oh, at least. And how do they pay for it?
Through a school bond. In fact, when I drove by it last night, I thought of Paul Doerr.
Right.
You know Paul Doerr.
Yeah.
And his ministry slash business of and I'm thinking, you know what? These small towns are saddled with so much unconscionable debt.
So much.
Because architects, engineers, contractors, school board members who are all big wigs in their community and above it all.
Right.
They basically play on the emotional naivete of the population. Oh, it's for the kids.
Right.
We want them to have this. Yeah. We want them to have that. So they've got an Olympic swimming pool in a high school for a community that had a total population of the county is 40,000 people.
Well, you take and take this too. They will obviously have bonds. If you take the annual budget, operating budget for our local school system and divide it by the number of kids, that's $8,400 per student per year. I think the national average is $9,200. Property taxes don't come close to covering that. So where are they getting this money from? Well, they do school bonds, which is pretty much they're telling the lender, hey, I promise to tax future generations against their will to pay for what I want right now. Oh, it's for the kids. We have to do it. And then we take government grant money. And supposedly we're a conservative town, right? These are the conservatives pushing this. So what do we do when the federal government comes into this town and says, hey, you have to let perverted men that dress up like women go and change with your daughter in the locker room? The school board will stand up and say, not us, we're not having that. You say, fine, we'll pull all your federal money away, and you can't operate. So they'll cave and they'll give in. We've sold any decision making. I mean, a school board is a farce. They have no power. They have no power on this stuff because the federal government has bought all their decision-making abilities. So instead, the federal government says, fine, we'll take all your money away.
Here's the problem. If you could somehow magically hack into the PA system of every church on Sunday morning at 11 a.m., and you could broadcast from a remote location like Anonymous and come in over it and say, look, we have an opportunity on Monday to end the public school reign of terror and monopoly by holding your children back because this day is going to be the day they do their head count to determine their funding, as Martin Salbrady was talking about. Most Christians would be appalled at that.
They'd say that's the worst thing ever. You don't care about our kids. You don't care about education. And going back on something we talked about a while ago about the Americanism, you know, which is what, that's the religion of the United States, is Americanism of who are professing evangelicals. And I talked about you can't go in there and change everything in a week. But there is a point. You do get to a point in one of these churches, for lack of a better word, to where it's the last straw. And mine, at a local one, and a friend of mine's a pastor, solid reformed guy, even though he's amillennial. But it was a Christmas Eve service. We have these Christmas trees up front, decorated with American flag ribbons, and we have the chief of the fire department marching around the sanctuary in his uniform, saluting the American flag Christmas tree. And this was the night before Jesus' born celebration. This is the this shows what the true God is. This shows what people are truly worshiping. They're worshiping the idea of a civil servant in uniform marching around saluting an American flag Christmas tree in the 45 minutes that they've set aside and out of their life that's supposed to be dedicated to the reverence of God. And there's no change in that. There's no change in that in some of these places. And it comes to a point where you've got to, you know what, I'm going to knock the dust off of my feet and go find a place where there are people that are really starving for the word of God.
My only suggestion would be, before you leave, fire broadside.
Well, I did.
Let them know yeah, while you're leaving. I stood up in some services.
I was preaching there on, me and another guy were rotating out on Sunday night, some Wednesday nights preaching. And I preached a sermon that I knew would be my last sermon there. And I didn't do it in the best spirit, but it was called 10, what did I call it? 10 Myths and Misconceptions of the American Evangelicals.
Do you have a Geneva gown?
I don't, but
that would help when you're delivering one of those.
But it was a couple of my friends that agreed with me were just sitting there. I'm so glad you said all that stuff. I can't believe you said it. Of course, all the blue hairs. They were the elders of the church, which are the deacons' wives.
Think about this. When you go into a courtroom, when your wife works in the court, mm-hmm, she's an officer of the courts. Are the judges wearing a gown?
Yes,
a robe. Yeah. Why? What is the purpose of that?
To show their authority?
Exactly. There's an authority, an office, that carries with it something beyond them as the man dressed in his
right
suit or whatever. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Well, I can tell you, and I agree with that, and I might get back to that over at the place I preach at, but the main reason I don't over there now is I'm trying to get them away from anything that resembles what the PCUSA does.
Oh, I know. I understand that. And here's the question. I was thinking about this the other day, and that is have you ever... I'm trying to think of cases, and War Room listeners, if you know of any cases, feel free to send these in on our discussion page after, you know, below the posting of this interview here, of any local congregations that have ever made sizable investments. Now, yes, they do it through their missions board, and they're sending money overseas and trusting it to somebody else. But what about sending money to a congregation across town that, let's say, just lost their sanctuary in a fire? I'd say don't rebuild it. Start meeting in your homes. But the idea is that when you've got, you know, in making an investment in the kingdom locally, people, you know, it was amazing to me when I joined a bunch of abolitionists over in North Central Tennessee one day. They were having a Love Your Neighbor weekend, and rather than talking about loving your neighbor by standing outside the local abortion clinics, they wanted to talk about loving your neighbor by sending money to Northeast Africa.
Right.
Yeah. To Somalia.
Yeah, right.
And I said, look, if you guys aren't up to attacking child sacrifice in your little community, stay on the porch because you ain't up to tackling Somalia.
Now, I'm going to give some credit to these, to the group of people that I've been preaching to over there, and no one knows them. None of our listeners will know, so that's fine. And they kind of have the don't let the left hand know what your right hand's doing attitude about things, because as far as I knew, they weren't really involved doing much around their community. But they're financially blessed. Small congregation, but I just buried a lady this summer that left us $52,000. You know? And that's what happens, you know? We operate, we don't have, we have 20-something people regularly attending, and our tithing probably doesn't cover the operating expenses, which we keep very low. But we get endowments from people. People die and pass away, so our coffers look really good. I think, well, why aren't we doing anything with this money? But, you know, I get to talk to one of the elders. Yeah, we gave this church across town, this predominantly black church in the poor part of the neighborhood. Their kids want to do something with their kids, their youth group, and do stuff, and we give them $1,000, and we give these people money. And, we're putting this woman up in a house across town because her husband's run off and she doesn't have anything, but no one knows about it. And it puts me in a situation to where I thought, well, if people knew about that and seen the things that we're doing, they might be interested in coming to church, coming to worship with us. You know, we can grow a little bit. But at the same time, I don't want to grow a congregation. I could grow that congregation and fill the place out in 3 months. All I'd have to do is what the contemporary whatever church down the road is doing, but I wouldn't be filling it the right way. I want an organic growth where you have one or two families coming a year, everybody working together for the real reason instead of using gimmicks to fill the church up. So I get worried about stuff like that.
Well, are you at somewhat cross purposes since you pastor in a community 20 miles from here, and your roots are in this community?
Right. Right.
How's that going to work long term?
I don't know.
You're not going to move to Malden.
I'm not going to move to Malden. I'm not going to. So I'm really split here. Now, you know, another small business.
What you need to do is plant a church here.
Right.
And have one of your elders go there and provide pulpit ministry.
Well, maybe down the road we can do that. I have a lot of work to do over there still yet.
Maybe I need to move back to Southeast
maybe
Missouri.
Maybe you do. This,
I can't imagine me preaching.
Oh, why not? Anybody can preach here. I know people.
No, I have preached. I did preach years ago when I was, I was about 27 years old, and I just gotten 26, and I just gotten out of the Navy, and I was brimming with navigator training and Calvinism, and I got a chance to preach in a little SBC church over in Lenora, Missouri one time, and I don't think they never heard a sermon like it, and they've never heard one since. And I think I gave them the whole 5 points twice.
Well, I have a couple good friends here in town that do pulpit supply, that are the other Reformed Calvinist guys that do pulpit supply for this association. And this is what I understand. This is what happens. And I'm not, I hate to sound like I'm dogging on the SBC all the time, because I'm not, but on this particular association, we'll have 8 churches that don't have a pastor that have like 20 people or less in each church. And we're like, why don't these people just get together? Well, they've split 40 years ago over something ridiculous, because when you look at their statement of faith, it's so vague. This guy can believe this. This guy can believe that.
Hey, they start sound pretty reformed.
Right. So
splitting. That's what we do best.
My friends, one of them in particular, go to these churches. They're expositors. No one's ever heard nothing like that. All they've heard is the same 3-point sermon preached over and over and over. Use a different scripture every week and say the same thing. And people that are really hungry for the word eat up expository preaching when they've never heard it before. And they said, will you be our pastor? And he'll lay it out and say, listen, here's my conditions. We're getting outside these church walls. We're going to do these ministries. We're going to minister to people around us. We're going to love our neighbor. And here's what I believe that the Bible says. Well, we can't believe that, you know. You believe in that predestination thing. You believe in this. And when I did my setting the record straight on the levels of ecumenicity, it's pretty inclusive. I'm not going to be like, one of the groups that I won't mention out loud right now, that if you don't hold to their doctrine 122%, then
Covenanters.
Yeah, then you're a heretic.
I'll mention it. It's right. My program.
But, which is ridiculous, you know. Because if you think that you understand it 100% right and you don't have something wrong, then you got to.
Well, here's the thing, you know, again, I'm not making any apologies right. for Covenanters. I'll give a shout out to Nathan Beatty. Nathan Beatty is a guy like you in a sense. Oh, he's not as big as you guys. He's a slender, wiry little guy. He's a roofer and a builder and a guy that is very much like you, a country guy. He's not afraid of any challenge. He'll take right. it on. He's a really likable guy, and he loves his Reformed theology, and he loves his liquor, and he loves his cigars, and he
right,
loves his
right.
family, and he loves the country, and he loves to shoot and pick up trucks with big tires, and
right.
he's just a good guy. And if you saw him walking into a Walmart, you'd think he was just a redneck hick,
right?
But he loves God. Now, admittedly, they get a little bit cross-eyed. I get a little bit cross-eyed over their infatuation with the form.
Right.
And it doesn't mean they don't love the substance, but they just love the form as much as the substance, it seems.
Right.
But, interestingly enough, I spent a night at his home. I didn't sleep there, but, I mean, we visited his home, and Ruger played with his kids and the whole deal. And everybody is easier to get along with when you're there with them in person.
Absolutely.
I mean, if we take our experience of how people are or aren't by Facebook, we're going to never get the real. We're never going to get the real person.
Right.
So one of the advantages of my little ministry / whatever it is that you call this that I do, is I get to go out and meet people and see them and sit across the and you know, a man's gift makes a way for him.
Absolutely.
You know, when I go see Joel McDermott, I know Joel likes books, cigars, and bourbon.
Right.
And, you know, so I'm saying there's, it's, Jesus tells us to be wise when you want to build bridges. I really am, I told you yesterday, and I'll tell it to my War Room listeners, I was raised in Southeast Missouri, and I couldn't wait to get out of here.
Yeah.
I was raised about an hour
right.
east of here, and I couldn't wait to get out. The day I graduated from high school, I got out of here. But when I see a man who has a concept of extending Christ's kingdom, and a guy that works, that is respected, not because you're a big name, but because
right.
you're because of personal integrity and hard work. And you have you're blessed with all the skills that real men in this part of the country look up to.
Right.
Hunting and fishing and that whole thing. And I'm sure you could hold your own in a fight. And yet you have got a small little formation of guys that maybe are not Reconstructionist, you know, in this full sense of
right.
5 points, but they're your friends or guys that are your running buddies.
Yeah.
And that you guys are claiming this country. You know that God has put you here together, and this
right.
relationship is a tactical relationship, strategic relationship. And I'm really interested to hear your strategy.
Well, I have some ideas I'd like to implement. I've talked to you about them before. One is, I'm starting a new business next year, a CSA, you know, community supported agriculture thing, which gives me an opportunity just to.
I'm glad you told me what CSA stood
right.
for. I thought it stood for something
it
else.
It does. It stands for two good things.
Yeah.
And anyway, so it gives me it'll give me a bigger opportunity to interact with the community. And you mentioned organic farming. I try to stay as organic as I possibly can. I'd never have the label organic because I don't want the federal government stepping foot on my property, let alone, you know.
So so if you use that label, you incur all sorts of.
Oh yeah, if you want to claim organic and be certified organic, you have to go through the big bureaucracy of the government on your property for years and years and years. And imagine this, you have to pay fines to people, and you have to pay to get certified, and you have to pay inspectors to come out, and you know, it's another tax is all it is. It's theft. They see a small guy wanting to do something, wanting to make some money, and they say, hey, how can we profit off of this? This is the government. How can we justify our bureaucracy and keep it going? So that's just how it works. So they can stay away. People can take my word, hey, I used these chemicals. I didn't use these chemicals, and there's how it is. You want to come out, look at my farm. You're buying stuff from me. You're more than welcome to come out, have a look at things. So that label aside, the purpose of this, people can eat healthy. People can see how God intends things to be. Now, I know with the big farming, we have to feed the world, and I understand all of this, but people that are interested in seeing the work and the result of work, they can come out and see where the work's done. They can participate in the fruit of the bounty.
How many people do you think your small operation will require?
It's just me and my family to start with. Pretty much that'll be it, and I'll just go from there. I've considered, hey, I can get some good labor, go to the agriculture classes here at the local college and say, hey, who wants to intern, kind of thing like that, you know. I've considered doing that. A lot of people that do these CSAs say, hey, go to the agriculture school and get a couple interns, you know, get a couple people to come out and learn, kind of deal. But it's not going to be a big financial moneymaker the first couple years. Now, if I get to a point to where it's very profitable and I can afford to hire somebody to help me like that, these first couple of years, it's going to be mostly just my hard work and somebody else's.
Now, your fence business, do you employ any people?
I have a couple guys that work for me. One of them, he was in the oil field, worked in the oil rig, and I said, man, you make more money than I do. Why do you want to work for me on your time off? And he says, well, if I'm working for you, I'm not spending my money. Really good worker. I went through a lot of guys, and I'll have a guy or two for extended periods of time until they move on to something bigger and better.
The other fellows that you consider to be your lieutenant, so to speak,
right?
In this area, mm-hmm. What sorts of are any of them? Are they basically like you in a sense that they're self-employed or they own things?
Yeah, Joe is he works for his cousin right now, and he's also does carpentry work for himself on the side, which he's been self-employed. He actually moved back to this area. He was down in Texas for a long time. We grew up, went to church together. He's a reformed guy. And I'll tell you something else. I thought my wife and I, when we were first dating, that we were the only people that subscribed to reformed theology in the town. And I run into Joe's wife one day in the middle of town. They've been out in Texas forever. And I said, hey, there you are. You know, I haven't seen you guys in a long time. And we get to talking about church stuff, and she talked about, hey, we want to get together and do a Bible study, just do stuff together in the home. And I said, well, okay. And we grew up independent, fundamental Baptists, and everything that entails. And I said, well, my fiance at the time, here's what we believe. We're kind of what you call Calvinists. She said, so are we. You know, it was such a providential thing that happened. You know, here they come back here. And he has felt that God's put him here to start a ministry, plant a church kind of thing, because they had the whole nine yards in Texas, the great big house and the beautiful suburbs and everything you'd ever want, successful business. And his parents needed him up here, family needed him, and he just felt called to come up here, as much as sometimes, as he would hate it sometimes, you know, just be so much easier just to go back to Texas. He was offered an associate pastor job that paid well in his old church back home in Texas, and as inviting and as that sounds.
He's doing pulpit supply now.
Yes, he's doing pulpit supply now. We get together and fellowship together once a week on Saturday nights. More than that if we can, you know, he's got a congregation unto himself with all their kids, you know. They're just like most Reformed people here. They have more kids than you can count. So,
I interviewed Tim. Right. He's playing today. He's got 10 kids, and they're all under 21.
Right. Well, that's Joe's got, he has 6 kids. He wants another one right away, but I think his wife's about done. But his oldest is 17, and he's got one that's 3. So, pretty good range there. my wife and I got a late start, so like I said, we have another one coming in December. But
and is there another family, a third family? Or?
There is. There's a third family, and he does pulpit supply as well. Joe and I are post-millennial. Adam is, he's working on it. He's working on it. He's getting there. He has a church he goes to over at Sykeston, which is a drive away too. But he might be moving to Sykeston.
Well, I'm going to give you a gift for your buddy.
All right.
When we come back out to the truck.
All right, sounds good.
I've got an audio CD mm-hmm. on post-millennialism by R.J. Rushdoony.
All right, I bet it's a good one.
Yeah, it is.
I bet it is.
I've already listened to it, so I'll give it to you. So you can give it to your friend. We want to keep it. We want to keep. Don't we? Right. We don't want to be a dead end to truth.
Right. Well, most people make this transition because the majority of the churches you're going to grow up in the United States are going to be pre-mill. Are going to be dispensational, the majority of them.
And I don't think it's because they've ever really investigated it.
That's what it is.
It's by default.
It's by default. It most definitely is. And so most people, when they discover Reformed theology, make this transition from pre-mill to... Now, I don't know what this... I never was in this historic pre-mill thing that Albert Mohler does. You know, it was the full...
Well, Spurgeon was a historical pre-mill.
Right. So we go from... usually that, and then into a-mill, and then you're a post-mill guy. I made the leap straight to post-millennialism because, really, when I looked at it, just from the very basic viewpoint, without a post-millennial eschatology, I don't see the sense in carrying out the Great Commission.
Well, because it was commanded.
Right.
Because
it was commanded,
You know, if you want to... Doug Wilson, who is quotable...
Right.
If you don't agree with everything he says, he's still quotable. And I think the designation optimillennial versus pessimillennial.
Right, that makes sense.
And I think, one of my closest, my very closest friend is a Reformed. He loves Rushdoony, he loves North, all these guys. But he also loves Jay Adams, and he is a millennial. Now, he's the most kingdom-driven, Christ-centered guy I know.
Right.
And I always tease him that he's a closet post-mill. Because when you talk to him, if you don't put any labels on it, he sounds post-mill.
Right.
Because he's all about victory and extending the kingdom and making disciples.
Right.
And the guy is fully engaged.
So he does agree
with the term optimillennial.
Right. Well, and the whole label thing, you know. Oh, you have to meet this exact form of labels or I can't do ministry.
Well, we talk about that a lot.
Well, so I look at this and I say, if I see even people over here that are by default dispensational, but they're in the community doing kingdom building work, of course I'm going to do stuff with them. Of course I'm going to do ministry together with them. Because even if on paper or what they claim, even if they don't understand what their church is teaching that way, because it isn't like every sermon every Sunday is on eschatology, you know, it's something they might touch on every now and then. Their actions speak louder than supposedly what their label is. And
there's a reason why that's an old saying, actions speak louder than words, because they do. You know, there's another CD that I could... that I got from Covenant Media is Greg Bonson. He's and he's teaching on Christian Reconstruction.
Right.
Calvinistic soteriology, presuppositional theonomy, covenant theology, and postmillennialism.
Right.
He never used one of those terms. And he was still teaching it.
And I've mentioned this to you before. We do it Tuesday nights. We fellowship and get together over there at Malden. And... I had a video study that we went through that I thought was pretty good, and someone said, hey, I want to bring this one from this other church down the road, and this is from, I'm not real familiar with this denomination, it's the Christian, First Christian Church.
One of the, it's like Disciples of Christ,
right.
It's liberal.
Right, so they go, one couple goes to that church.
They'll ordain anybody.
Right, like on a Wednesday night or something, they go over there since we don't do a Wednesday night service of any kind. So they go over there on Wednesday night, and they're involved, she's involved in... picking kids up, taking them over there to do children's ministry or whatever. She said, I want to bring this thing called Truth Project from the Focus on the Family people. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is going to be junk, you know. But I said, okay, you know, bring it. We'll go through it. This man, Del Tackett, was the president of Focus on the Family at the time. He never used Kuyper's name. He never used theonomy. He never said Reconstruction. But that's all the study was, from the ground up, sphere sovereignty.
You know, it brings,
and it was great, you know. And
so a takeaway right. from this is that you can say, maybe with some exceptions, right. you can say anything you need to say if you know how to say it.
Right, absolutely. But people just, of course, well, the lemmings that most of the lay people in the church are nowadays, they watch this video, they shake their head, yeah, that sounds good. Well, we discussed this into great detail, and this Truth Project was great. I mean, it has you looking at everything you look at through the lens of Christianity, which it should be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, down to electing government officials, down to our laws that govern us, and it was great. It was really good stuff. I mean, it was Kuyper is what it was. It was Kuyper's teachings pretty much, which the anti-theonomic crowd, which seems to be a lot of the Reformed Church nowadays, will just...
Well, people would say, I mean, if you've read about Kuyper, yeah. Kuyper was inconsistent.
Right.
Kuyper was not what we would call a Christian Reconstructionist, even though he came up with the sphere sovereignty
right,
concept, which he borrowed from
Dewey
Vierd.
Right.
And even, you know, by today's standards, Dabney or Thornwell, mm-hmm. those guys were not theonomists.
Right.
Christian Reconstructionism is... And you know, and I love my friends mm-hmm. in American Vision and Chalcedon
yeah.
and Gary North and all the guys at Reconstructionist mm-hmm. Radio. There are multitudes of little groups around. It seemed like every day someone is sending me an invitation to join or like another podcast or
right.
group. I just
right.
recently, there's a group of young people down in Alabama. There's a group of Reconstructionist dads up in Washington State.
Yeah.
The Botkins
right.
are coming online with a applied theology podcast.
Are they?
That Scott Buss is, he's
right.
I think he'll soon be an elder there, but he's up to his eyeballs in politics there in the state capital in Tennessee. And they've got their podcast. So there are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal, and just because they're not tuning into the War Room or Reconstructionist Radio
right.
does not mean that they're not boots on the ground.
Absolutely.
And there are a lot of people under the radar.
I was super impressed with the... I know this isn't what they're going for, but I'm going to call it the Botkin Commune when we visited it down there. But no, it's not really. They took advantage of the place they bought there, and I liked what they had going on. One of the best places I visited, when I said, hey, this is what body of Christ should look like gathering together, even if I don't agree 150% with all the theology, there was nothing. If I lived there, well, I'd be going to church with them.
Yeah, it's a good little group. My first impression, the first time I ever visited there at Scott Buss's invitation, I loved it, and mm-hmm. I noticed right off the bat that every head of every household, family, mm-hmm. couple, every adult male is considered an elder in training.
That's the way it should be.
And you could go there two or three Sundays straight and never mm-hmm. hear Jeff, who is sort of the lead elder,
yeah.
never hear him say a word.
Yeah, well, elder in training is a good way to say it, because they're already, whether they're performing the duty correctly or not, the priest of their own household, and should be treated as such. And if they're not carrying, if the man of the house is not carrying out that role properly, the rest of the body of Christ needs to come together and kind of give him a kick in the butt and point him in the right direction and say, hey, listen, man, you're responsible for these people. The lazy thing to do would just be to turn them over to the church and say, oh, the church is responsible for me and my family, and to lead them up in the way that they should go, which, you know, and by the way, we'll fail at that.
Just spending time with them, plugged in, mm-hmm. you know, over the last few years, I've had guys come in and out that I thought that I was discipling, and I was funneling good books to them and trying to hold them accountable, but... They don't. You can't make them. You can't
right.
hold their feet to the fire.
It. You can't do it.
You can't want it for them more than they want it for themselves.
I'm gonna tell you a guy I've been investing some time in, and it's not someone to the extent of you're saying that is in a position where, like, hey, this guy's ready to go out and minister. It's actually he's far from it. It's a guy, one of the guys I was talking about that works for me. When he's off the oil riverboat now, he went and got a riverboat job because of oil. Until the price of oil comes up, you know, he's off the oil rig. But I see this guy, super, super good guy. Great attitude. I see him acting exactly like I did when I was his age. He spends way too much money on stupid stuff. He's engaged, lives with his fiance, doing everything backwards as far as that goes. But he has asked me, hey, will you marry us? I said, I will. I said, but I'm going to require that your fiance, that you and your fiance sit down with me and my wife for an extended period of time. I said, we're going to go through some counseling on this stuff. And I'm in a position to where we're friends. I'm not really his boss. I mean, when I hire these guys to work for me some, I say, hey,
I get it.
Here's a guy I can disciple, right? If I'm not putting time into these guys, where it's just...
So he's a believer?
He is a believer in the sense of, yes, oh, yeah, I believe in God. I believe in this, just like we've been raised up to be. But his life's pointing in a different direction. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Which a bunch of us have been in before.
Well, I worked both riverboats and oil rigs.
Right. So you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And you were in the Navy, too. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So, but he's easy to influence, and I've gained his respect.
How old is he?
23.
Oh, he's young and dumb.
Right. So he's easy to influence, and I've gained his respect. So I said, well, here's an opportunity for me to point a guy in the right direction, say, listen, here's where I quit making these mistakes you're making. And because I made the exact same mistakes, point him in the right direction and get him on track the right way. And I've been investing some time.
Let me give you a tactic.
Yeah.
Ask him, you got a pretty good memory?
Right.
He'll say, yeah, I got a pretty good memory.
Yeah.
And give him a card with scripture on it.
Right.
Give it a topic. You've heard of the topical memory system?
Yes.
The TMS? Give him a topical memory system. And call it, you know, at the top, and just write it out. Give him a 3x5 card. Christ the center, Galatians 2:20, and 2 Corinthians 5:17. Write them out.
Right.
And say, memorize, learn this by heart, and give it to me next week.
Right.
And I'm going to call you on Tuesday night for you to be able to quote it back to me.
Yeah.
Now, if you'll do that, see, because once that word gets into his noggin,
it's there.
His mind will start to become transformed by the word.
Absolutely.
And that will begin to reprogram him or debug him.
Right. You asked about what verse has been on my mind lately. Well, I've been drilling Ephesians 2:8 through 10 into my son. Of course, he's 6. And the very best way I found to really learn the meaning of particular scriptures is, well, I have an extremely inquisitive son, 7 years old. And I can quote scripture to him. Well, what does that word mean? What does this word mean? What is that? I don't understand that. What does that exactly mean? And you find yourself having to delve so deep into this to explain it in a way that he can understand. And sometimes you even find, you know what, maybe I don't really understand what this means. Maybe I'm just sitting here reciting stuff over and over that I've heard so many times. And I have a 7-year-old that wants me to explain this in a way to him that is so completely understandable. Like he was asking me this morning, because, you know, I'm a 20-minute drive into town, you know, driving to school in the mornings, and, you know, just me and him in the truck, and this is kind of stuff we have to talk about. And he'll say, how exactly do I get saved? What exactly does that mean? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to say? And it's so easy to want to jump to like a sinner's prayer scenario type thing, but instead you have to break it down and explain, hey, exactly what it means. And it's actually pretty simple. It's not as complicated as you might think it would be. So, or as we make it to be, Jesus puts it pretty simple, you know, just believe in him, put your faith in me and believe in me, you know. Pretty simple stuff, really, when it comes down to it. And yesterday morning, I was listening to, I forgot what podcast I was listening to, but the word abortion was mentioned. He said, what's that? What is that? And I explained it to him, and he was appalled. He could not believe. He said, you mean doctors actually do that? Doctors actually kill babies? He said, that's the worst thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. He said, there's nothing worse than that. He said, that's murdering people. No one told him that. I didn't tell him, hey, this is murder. He just knew it. He knew this is the worst thing. And I had to calm him down from it a little bit. He's a pretty emotional kid. And, of course, you know, my wife's sitting here 8 months pregnant, you know, about 7-8 months pregnant, about to have a baby. He just couldn't fathom why in the world somebody would do that. And I said, hey, it happens 3,000 times a day in our country. And it just blew his mind.
I suspect.
He just couldn't imagine. And at first, I kind of thought, well, do I need to put this on this?
Well, you've seen all the AHA kids.
Oh, yeah.
The kids of AHA out. Right. They make some of the most potent evangelists.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'll tell you what. Again, people say, well, they probably have an abortion mill in this community. This is a regional center. They certainly have one in Cape, but they don't have one here.
Well, I know all the OBs in this area pretty well. One that I know that would have possibly done them before, he passed away last year.
Well, they have CVS or Walgreens.
Yeah, so I know.
But the point,
and
the point is that every high school, as the kids are the junior college students, as the boyfriend girlfriend shacking up routine, as they produce babies, they will find a place. They will find a way. They'll go to Cape Girardeau, or they'll go to Springfield, or they'll go to Jonesboro or Memphis.
Yeah.
And so there's still a need for a ministry, an education ministry, at the local community college and high schools.
Absolutely.
And there's an opportunity right there.
It's a great opportunity right there. And especially...
So I'll get back. So I'll check back in with you in 6 weeks and see how you're doing.
Especially in a lower income area like this, because... I mean, that's who they prey on. You know, that's who they convince that, hey, this is the best deal for you. And but we were talking about the kids being the best witness, because you and I at the murder mill, a lot of times what we're going to say is going to come out of anger, just because we see it so much, we know what these people are doing. And if I was to take Landon, my 7-year-old, he'd be sitting there bawling and crying, I can't believe you're doing this, why are you going to kill your baby? And the sad emotion and the love for that baby is what would overwhelm him and make him so effective at something like that, to where, not that you and I wouldn't feel those same emotions too, but they would convert into, I know me, I'm not going to speak for you, I know me, it converts into anger.
Well, again, it's two are better than one.
Right.
Because if one falls, the other will lift up his companion. If one of us were to devolve into anger, the other would say, Bill, calm down.
Right.
Or...
You want to,
and by the same token, as we're driving along, we see a situation, and say, "Hey, let's talk to this guy."
Right.
And you, it may not have been on your radar, or it may not have been on mine. You say, "Hey, there's an opportunity over here." So it really is. It's important if we're going to be tactical to go into battle. And probably part of my shortcoming is that I don't have a live person, and a lot of times I think about, Lord, am I going to be in this truck for the rest of my natural born days, or should I move into a small little community where I can begin to put my boots on the ground and pick up a shovel, and you know, it's so. I told you the other day, I said I haven't been excited about Southeast Missouri in 4 decades.
Right.
But
it's hard to get excited, it is.
But if you've got a group of guys that are hitting it,
that's what it takes.
It's exciting because there's activity that you can join in a group of guys. People talk, you know,
And I'll tell you, and when you know you're going in the right direction is when the spiritual warfare comes in, because, you know, I can take my buddy Joe, and as far as we get together and studying and doing stuff, Joe's a couple years older than me. Well, he's exactly 4 years older than me. We share a birthday. But he,
how old are you?
How old am I? 37.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so Joe's bought a brand new house here. 2 weeks after he closed on the house, his mom passes away. His mom and dad lived in the house that he built for him and his family before he moved away. So now here he is with two houses, with a house that he just bought that he has to sell because he can't afford both houses at the same time. So, of course, that sucks up a lot of their time, that, between work and this and that. And there's always something that the enemy always puts in the way to...
The enemy?
Well...
You need to rethink that.
Yeah. There's always something that I think...
I think the enemy will always try to take the things, the circumstances that
go.
We're in,
and use them again.
The circumstances are providential. The enemy will play upon our own human nature to misperceive opportunities as obstacles.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%. So anyway, stuff like that comes up, kind of gets away. And where was I going with this train of thought here? Oh, it's kind of going back to what we were talking about on the Murder Mill Ministries. And if you don't want this on your program, edit it out. I don't mind people hearing me saying it. You and I look at this parking lot right now, and we see a man out there with a gun about to kill his little 2-year-old child. He'd have to be pretty fast at it before I'd get out there and put a stop to it. And it would be my duty as a Christian to do so, as loving my neighbors myself. Because if it was our child, we wouldn't hesitate to do so, and we'd be totally justified doing it. Love our neighbors ourselves. Truly love our neighbors ourselves, and we're going to do the same thing for our neighbor.
Yeah, we are in a schizophrenic culture.
Right, so I see a man escorting his child into a government murder mill to be assassinated.
That's why Operation Rescue.
Right.
We did it in the 80s, and yeah. I've got a buddy of mine who was arrested 50 right. times.
And I look at that, and of course, if I was to do what the law of God required me to do, they'd lock me up in prison. And that...
You mean burn the altars of Moloch?
Right. Or...
We can't... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, of course, you say that. And then, you know, a popular Facebook group, biggest one there on Facebook that I know of, that labels itself Reformed, which there's some awesome... Oh, all right, guys in there. And it comes up on my feed, and I avoid it most of the time. But someone puts the question on there yesterday... On the Reform Pubcast thing, what is the if abortion's made illegal, should the woman be charged with murder and get the death penalty?
If abortion was made illegal, the only abortions would be illegal
right.
would be murder.
Right. Absolutely. That was the question, and you know which requires a pretty simple answer. So of course people go back and forth on their saying no, and they say why do you think it should require the penalty that God prescribes for murder? And I said, well, let's take it back to,
and this is on a mature Reformed podcast.
I mean, well, there's some mature people there, but mature is not the way I would describe this. It was on a Facebook group. Mature is not the way I would describe this group. Anyway, so you look at it, and I said, well, you're all labeling yourself as Calvinists. Let's look at what Calvin has to say about the functions of God's law. Let's look at the second function of the law, the civil use of the law. What's the purpose of the civil use of the law?
Restrain evil.
It's restrain evil. Restrain evil by instilling fear in the unrighteous to protect the just. And if the unrighteous know that, hey, if I do this that God prohibits, here is the prescription that God gives for the punishment, which is if I am to murder someone, it's a capital punishment, which there's very few capital crimes. I said, so we don't see God throwing people in prison. We see restitution to the
victim.
And
people think that we're killing people all the time. And the fact is that if capital punishment were used consistently, it wouldn't be necessary very much.
It would be a deterrent. A lot better deterrent than, hey, let's put you in, lock you up and give you 3 squares a day in a place
to stay. And then 20 years from now, the lethal injection at midnight where no one hears about it and nobody can even remember the crime.
Right.
Yeah, that's real effective.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's also, you know, it's real effective when, let's say, I was to go out here. You pull up here in your vehicle. You have your liability insurance. I go out and steal it, go for a joyride, and total your vehicle. And then the government finds me. I pay money to the government, and they lock me up, and you're left without a car. And
you heard Bojidar's podcast yesterday on restitution?
It's in my queue to listen to today.
Okay.
I will. I really enjoyed his podcast on the prison system, though. I mean, just for housing. I don't understand the point.
Well, we need to pray for Bojidar, because anybody that is that high, that valuable to the body of Christ is... there's a bounty on his head. He's a high-value target.
Absolutely.
And so we need to remember that those brothers who are a blessing to you, you need to pray for them, that the Lord will not allow them to become fall victim to pride or to any of the things that take out high-profile men and women who are actually doing something. So we...
Another thing real quick, I never actually... We have never actually pinned this down. We go off on tangents here. What's one of my plans? What's something that I'm wanting to do to really kingdom building in the community? And I've mentioned this to you several times. I talked about this community-supported agriculture thing I'm going to do. And I believe that's one of the talents God's blessed me with.
I'm going to give you another idea.
Do this.
Give you another idea. Charter a bus.
Uh-huh.
And go around to some of these small...
Right.
Dying congregations where they really don't even have a justification for existing.
Right.
They should have already joined and merged with other local congregations. Charter a bus and take a bunch of people from different congregations over to see the Ark Encounter.
That'd be neat. I need to go check that out. Yeah.
And the reason I say that, because everybody would be excited about it going, and it gives you that time on the bus to fellowship with people from other congregations.
That's a good idea. That's a real good
idea. You see that? If you just say, won't you come over to our, we're having a revival this week. Won't you come over?
Right.
We got a special guest speaker. But if you're going to charter a really nice bus, in other words, you're not going to use one of the public school system yellow buses.
Right.
You're going to charter a real nice ride. And we're all going to go over and see. We're going to go over for 2 days. And the first day we're going to spend at the Creation Museum.
Yeah.
And the second day we're going to spend at the Ark Encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And brother, I would bet you that those people will be your friends. They'll be your fast friends when you come back. And in that intervening time, there and back, you have a chance to talk about working together and loving one another in the bluff, and working together is the prelude to let's close shop over here where we're barely keeping our head above water.
Yeah.
Why don't we join our brothers over here?
Yeah, absolutely.
You see, that trip could do it, and you're using something that has a universal appeal.
Right.
The Ark Encounter.
Yeah, right.
Because they can look it up on the internet and say, oh, hey, there's these guys going to go. They're chartering a bus, and it's going to be leaving from Dexter High School on this day going to the Ark Encounter. It's going to be a Christian field trip.
Yeah.
All churches are, you might have to have 2 or 3 buses. Would that be something?
Yeah, that'd be a good deal.
And they can, they say, well, do we want to go or not? All they got to do is look on the internet and say, yeah, that looks cool. Let's go.
Right.
The opportunity is that you've got them as a captive audience for 5 hours.
And they can't get away from me. They're stuck on a bus.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, but what I was talking about, so the little farm and garden thing, and I've mentioned this to you several times.
Sorry for the rabbit
trail. No, that's fine. The community I'm in over there, especially among the minority families, there's a big fatherless, we've talked about this, big fatherless issue. These kids grow up.
African-American or Hispanic or both?
African-Americans. They grow up with no dads around. You know, and we talked about this before, they're either raised by their moms, more likely they're raised by their grandmas. You know, so they grow up, they're born into a place to where their whole life is subsidized by the government. They aren't taught, not that people don't pull out of this, as a lot of people do, and it's just, and you know, not being racial here, just don't happen around black people. We can look around this county, and so many people on the government know, white folks included, especially white folks here, but they come up in this lifestyle that's completely subsidized by the government, and they don't understand, actually, they're never taught because they don't have a father figure, and they're never taught, hey, here's what you do, you instill pride in your work, you work, here's the reward returned on your work. And I really believe we can have sort of a ministry, and I've told you before, and in this neighborhood over here, in this, everybody's got a backyard, and that's farming country over there. And I could take these kids, I'd like to take them 6, 7, 8 years old. You know, it really gets hard by the time you get to 14 or 15. But take them and instill in them, hey, here's how we do something from start to finish. Let's put a garden in your backyard. What can you do to help grandma out around the house? Here's some things you can do to provide for yourself and see a return on the investment of your work.
I'd give them a calf to raise.
Yeah. See a return on the investment in your work. And a lot of them live on the same street, and they all might be in little rental houses, whatever. They all have a backyard big enough to raise. If you don't think your backyard's big enough to raise a big garden, I watched a documentary of a guy that has 0.6 acres over in Southern California in the middle of the city, living under the overpass that supports his entire family plus sells $25,000 worth of stuff to the
restaurant. Can you just put seed in ground? I mean, you're preparing. Well, things like Garden of Eden is a great documentary. Yeah. But the question is, what sorts of things would they need to do to prepare ground? That's another discussion.
Yeah. Well, pretty simple. You know, everybody's mowing their yards around there. And I've thought about this too because, and this is kind of providential, on my drive over there every two or three times a week, there is somebody, for whatever reason, they got a big barn and they sell hay and they said barrels for sale. And they got like 500 barrels stacked up over here. And I'm thinking, I wonder if I tell this guy about the ministry, how cheap I can get these barrels, because I can make a compost barrel in everybody's yard that wants to do this over here. And hey, they can throw their table scraps in here. They can throw their lawn clippings in here and they can have a compost. They're making their own natural kind of fertilizer.
Earthworms?
They'll end up with worm castings and all this stuff. And they can raise these gardens in their backyard. They can see the miracle of God's creation right there, and actually, just as we get to do in people's salvation, we don't have anything to do with
it. And gardening is good for people's soul, isn't it?
Well, just the same way when we go out, we're called to carry out the Great Commission. We go out and evangelize somebody. We're not saving anybody, but one of the benefits of getting to be a Christian is God allows us to participate in that miracle and see it with our own eyes. And it's the same thing with him revealing himself to us in creation. And if we're doing something like this, working the ground, as the very first thing Adam was commanded to do, he's sitting here tending the garden, we're working the ground and we see this miracle of, look what God has done for us. He's given us ability to do this. And then, hey, I've done such a good job. God's enabled me to do such a good job raiding this garden in my backyard. I have enough to share with my neighbor. Or my neighbor's doing it too, and we can trade stuff
together. Do they allow chickens in the city limits there? In
Malden? I'm sure they do. I'm sure it depends. I would say it depends on what street you live on.
I would say it'd be another, having a couple of chickens.
Right.
I mean, I've been talking with my buddy Jack about this.
Yeah.
You know, when we think of tyranny, we oftentimes think of civil government.
Right.
But let's face it, food tyranny. There's no freedom unless you have food freedom.
Right.
If a government controls the food. Pipeline.
Which they do. I mean, speculators set commodity prices all the time.
FDA, yeah. USDA, they control the food. Ultimately, they control you. I mean, we've heard of municipalities that have basically issued citations for people growing vegetables in their front yard.
Oh, yeah.
Rhubarb in their front yard.
Well, we won't have that problem. See, I'm lucky enough. That's a community I can do something like this, and then because we're not going to have that problem. It isn't because you have the guy living on the street.
You've talked about this with your elders, or have you talked about it with any of the city officers?
Actually, yes, we have. We started last year, and actually, I'm kind of glad that God's postponed it for a year because now that we've voted ourselves out of the apostate denomination, I feel more comfortable.
Have you got a name yet?
No, we're still just Malden Presbyterian Church. That's just where we're at right now.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. So anyway, we had it was actually one of the elders' ideas. He said, "What would you think about doing a community garden?" I said, "I think that's a great idea. Let's do it." You know, because first thing I was thinking, I can get these kids that have absolutely nothing to do in the summer but cause trouble, and say, "Hey," and they can see start to finish how to do something. They'll have something to show, take pride in it. You know, and then I can come alongside that with the gospel. I mean, the gospel's in everything we look at. God's put the gospel so plain to us everywhere in creation and just showing it to these kids. Anyway, it was an idea, and we had a place to do it, but it kind of fell through. But the city has offered us. The city said, hey, we got these empty lots over here. Use them whenever you want. So we actually have a place. It's not as centrally located, but it's small and small. It's still close located. I believe this is over by the public library over there. So the city says, yeah, we're not using these lots. We're having to pay guys to mow them all the time. You guys just take care of them. You can have them. And so the city...
Joel Salatin talks about, why do churches even have lawns?
Right.
Why don't they have garden? Why doesn't every... Yeah. You know, there's enough unused land in the communities of America to feed the world.
That's what he said. He was talking about that. Some lady asked him about in Vermont... well, what do we do with our unseasonal vegetables? And he said, if everybody put a solarium on the side of their house in the backyard, you wouldn't have to import a thing from California. You know, you wouldn't have to have this produce that has to be genetically modified to, not that I want to put you out of a job, Bill, but to ride in the back of a truck for 2,500 miles and still survive the trip.
Yeah, speaking of which, I probably need to get back on the road, and you need to do too. This has been just sort of a friendly, in the Heartland Travel Plaza in Poplar Bluff, sort of a brainstorming. Of course, always love to see you. We'll have to get out there to the farm sometime.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have to.
And do some shooting and barbecuing and things like that. Meet your by that time you'll have. Do you know the gender of your new child?
I do. We last time we didn't, but yeah, I'm having a little boy, another little boy. So three boys. We did this time because I said, hey, we're building the house, and this is going to decide.
You got a name yet?
Levi Thomas.
Well, I've got a grandson named Oscar Levi. So Levi is evidently pretty popular.
Must
name.
Be. I said. We were looking for a middle name, and I let my wife kind of sweat it out for a few days because she didn't know. I said, what about Levi Garrett? She said, that sounds really nice. And I finally told her about a week later. I said, well, you know, that's chewing tobacco, right? So she nixed that one. But I thought I'd better tell her now until after it was on the birth certificate. But anyway, I know if anyone else is doing anything kind of like that in the any of our listeners or know someone that's doing that, my idea with the gardening thing or their church.
Reach out to you on Facebook.
Yeah, reach out to me. I'd sure like to. Or someone says, hey, I got a better idea how you can do this. I really would like some input.
Okay, super. Well, Derek Evans, we appreciate you for joining us here on the War Room.
All right, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us in the War Room. Please enjoy The Nation's Rage, Psalm 2, by My Soul Among Lions.
Why do the nations rage? Why do the peoples die?